Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. Welcome to Legal Face Off here on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Legals are here. To my right, Rich Linkoff. To my left, Tina Martini. Ben Anderson is behind the glass. And my name is Sam Panionovic. A whole lot of things to get to per usual. Legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we start with something that continues to change by the moment, and that is the Jeffrey Epstein situation. And joining us is Jack Donson, former longtime Federal Bureau of Prisons case manager, PrisonologyX.com, also worked with FedCure, and his website, MFPCLLC.com. Jack also wrote an op-ed for The Hill, and he's busy as the moments go on. Jack, how do we keep this in perspective here with how this has changed, not only over the past week, but even in the last 24 hours?
Yeah, it's finally coming to where it needs to go, because everybody initially was portraying this as a rogue MCC staff story, you know, officers not doing their jobs, and it couldn't be more farther from the contrary. This is a systemic agency, cultural, like, broader issue, and I'm glad the actions today by Attorney General Barr kind of are addressing that broader leadership void.
Yeah, Jack, the news today, obviously, is that Attorney General Barr announced that he was appointing a new director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Kathleen Hawk Sawyer, who was previously in that role for 11 years, beginning in 1992. Is this move just for show, or is this something that will actually solve some of the problems that you've touched on in your op-ed piece?
Well, listen, it's a two-edged sword. I mean, I try to play fair and maintain good relationships with everyone, but I've advocated for an outside director since actually late 90s, and they finally picked General Lynch, and I was so happy to get outside leadership. So while I don't have anything really, I don't have a critique of Kathleen Hawk Sawyer because I worked under her when she was a director, nothing really negative comes to mind, but it is still the same old agency culture. You know, she was at the beginning of the growth in the agency where I believe all these cultural changes started, and then the director Kane just retired a few years ago. So I respect them, you know, for their service, but it's still the same old, same old. It's the old guard. We don't need the old guard. We don't need XBOP people that were responsible with this culture to get us in this predicament that we're in right now.
So do you think that the Metropolitan Correctional Center violated protocol here at all?
Well, listen, I'm only going by reports, but the individual officers, if they did not do their 30-minute checks, obviously violated protocol. If they, you know, they did not take him off suicide watch prematurely because he was literally on suicide watch twice as long as the average person. But if protocols, yeah, I'm going to make an assumption that some protocols were violated. But then again, that is not why Mr. Epstein is dead. Mr. Epstein is dead because you can kill yourself within a matter of minutes, regardless of if they did adequate 30-minute checks or not. So you cannot stop an inmate in federal prison from committing suicide, no matter how hard you try. Could they put a camera on them constantly, you know, Monday morning quarterback? I guess there's some things outside the polity parameters that could have been done, but I'm telling you, as far as policy-wise goes, you're not going to stop an inmate from committing suicide.
So in this case, we've heard a lot about the lack of resources in this particular facility, and that was a reason why there weren't enough guards monitoring this suicide watch. Do you agree with that? I mean, you're saying that it doesn't really matter how many.
That's what I'm saying. This is not a facility issue. This is going on all over the United States. It's been going on for decades all over the United States. Look at rated capacity reports for inmate populations. Look at staff complement. This is not an MCC issue as far as the understaffing. What I don't like is something very erroneous in responsible reporting is there was a non-guard on the watching Mr. Epstein. Listen, every BOP person from the secretary to the warden is hired with the understanding everybody's correctional officers first. We all go to a federal law enforcement training center, FLETC, in Glencoe, Georgia. We all qualify with the M16 9mm every year, including the secretary. When the institution disruption happens, the secretary's grabbing keys, she's cuffing inmates. I'm being a little dramatic, but everybody are correctional officers first. So the narrative of a non-guard is totally absent of any reality in the federal prison system. We do not have civilian employees.
So what was different about Epstein's incarceration when you look at it from a correctional perspective?
Yeah, what's different is the management issues that he raised, because you have to understand this. First of all, he's brought publicity. So that's another false narrative where people are saying, did Washington know, did the region know? A broad publicity case is it's considered part of what's called the Central Inmate Monitoring Program, where inmates of broad publicity are flagged. So everybody knows what's going on with Mr. Epstein or what was going on with Mr. Epstein, so people could put their head in the sand. It's not really the warden making all these decisions. The warden's the final authority, but he's keeping the regional office in Philadelphia in the loop, which is the regional director, and he's keeping the assistant director of the Correctional Programs Division in Washington, who works for Mr. Hurwitz, in the loop as well. So from the management standpoint to me, which was so hard to manage this case, was the broad publicity. Now we have not only broad publicity, he's a sex offender, which they are not popular in the prison setting. So, and then even more so, he's a pretrial inmate. Pretrial inmates have the legal right to remain separated from other prisoners, and the MCC has convicted prisoners, and MCC has convicted prisoners in all their units. So he had the right to go to special housing, and, you know, like, it was like, it was really a between a rock and a hard place. And so those management concerns, from the broad publicity to being the sex offender to him having the right to reside in the special housing unit, which is where most suicides occur per our annual training, you know, those management issues really caused the Bureau of Prisons to you know, a lot of issues and challenges. And then if I'm going to Monday morning quarterback this, I'm going to say, not even though it was not required in policy, should the warden in hindsight had a thought about it and say, you know, maybe I better put him in a cell with the camera directly on him. Listen, you can Monday morning quarterback that, but I'll tell you this, it's not required by policy. We had the blind Egyptian cleric Omar at Otisville 1 year, and our warden was outside the box thinker. We put a camera on Omar worried about the Egyptian followers if something happened to them, and, you know, riots and things like that. So that outside the box mentality is part of what my op-ed is. That leadership outside the box thinking is not around today in the culture of the agency. I'm sorry to ramble.
Jack, last question here on Legal Face-Off. What's the biggest misconception you think that lay people have about the federal prison system?
Short answer, inmates are people too.
How so? Could you expand on that?
Well, yeah, everybody's big on, you know, like, the prison is unknown, and, you know, people, like, cast judgment on prisoners as if, you know, they're not a prisoner, and nobody understands, you know, prisoners just people. There's many reasons why people commit crime, and there's such a lack of education of prison issues that prisoners are treated like a special second-class citizen, and it could be, you know, it could be one of our family members, and I don't know how to explain that, but people associate prisoners with something bad, something negative, and that's all due to the lack of education about our prison system, the reasons behind crime, and how the United States became the incarceration nation in the first place.
He is Jack Donson, former longtime Federal Bureau of Prisons case manager, the website mfpcllc.com. Jack, thanks for your time, sir.
Anytime.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to LFO on WGN. Rich Lankoff and Tina Martini joining us now on the phone. State Representative Keith Wheeler from District Number 50 on this new elimination of the statute of limitations for sex crimes. Representative, welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So, Representative, last month, Governor Pritzker signed House Bill 2135 into law, which lifts the statute of limitations for criminal sexual assault, aggravated criminal sexual assault, and aggravated criminal sexual abuse, and it's effective January 1st. You were a co-sponsor of this measure. Can you tell us a little bit more about this law?
Actually, this one, I was actually the sponsor for this law. This is one we've been working on for a few years now. We had a constituent of ours from Yorkville who came to our office named Mary Ann Broska. She has a daughter who was a victim of sexual assault and had concerns about the evidence process and getting things done in a timely enough fashion in Illinois that she wanted to have us lift that statute of limitations entirely. We did research on our end naturally. We filed the bill on her behalf and explained it's going to be a process to get this done. This is not something that generally happens instantly. So a couple years later and a few hearings where she got to testify on behalf of her situation, and we matched up our legislation with what other states had done that we thought made sense. We got it to a committee hearing and got it to a vote this year. And once we got it to that vote, it moved very quickly from there.
So why, I mean, it's great. Congratulations for getting that done, because obviously it's something that is really important. We've covered that on this show extensively. Why did it take so long? I mean, in light of the Me Too movement that we've seen, Illinois became the eighth state to pass legislation eliminating the statute of limitations. And we get it. You know, these things take time, but usually they take time because there are lobbying efforts on, you know, the other side. It would seem hard to believe that someone would lobby against the extension or the elimination of statute of limitations in this case. So tell us a little bit about the challenges you faced in bringing this bill to the governor's desk.
Yeah, no, these points well taken. We did not see a lot of direct opposition from, like you said, advocacy groups or, you know, a lobbying effort. Rather, this was more of a philosophical issue that the House has been taking on for a number of years regarding trying not to expand every time, you know, a situation occurs where we write a bill, pass a law, and then put more people in jail without maybe always thinking the whole process through. So this became an education effort on our end to reach out to other legislators, particularly on the Jude Krim Committee that was going to hear the bill, and explaining how, you know, this would really impact the people in the state of Illinois, and it would not be an effort just to find more people incarcerated, but rather to find justice for the victims, you know, of these horrific crimes that shouldn't have to work against an arbitrary time frame.
So statutes of limitations are in place to help guard against things such as wrongful convictions, which sometimes happen when there's a significant time gap in bringing charges for a crime. So when you weigh that against the atrocities of sex crimes and the inability of victims to come forward, how does the new law balance those competing interests?
Well, the balance is still held primarily by the prosecutor, because they have full discretion as to whether or not they can proceed with a case based on the evidence they actually have. What we are totally aware of is the fact that advances in DNA and the ability to acquire DNA evidence can match it against databases that exist now or in the future is a huge lever to getting this right. So we're not doing, effectively the opposite of what the intention is. We don't want to put the wrong people behind bars. We're trying to find the perpetrators and prosecute them. And this gives us a chance to do that.
Representative, through this process, what did you learn from your constituent as well as other victims of sexual assault about the difficulty that they encounter when coming forward? One of the reasons, of course, you worked through this issue was because it is so difficult for victims, particularly of sexual assault, to come forward. What did you learn about those reasons and the difficulties that people have and why it takes so long sometimes for people to come forward?
Well, that's probably one of the things I was not perfectly prepared for. I don't come from a background where I deal with this issue on a regular basis. And what happened to me personally was so many people reached out to me, young, old, male, female, and told me their stories. They put a real face to this crime, and certainly inspired me as well as my entire staff to move forward and find a balance that will work for everybody here and give them an opportunity for justice whenever that justice comes.
How much did the Bill Cosby case assist your efforts? Because that was obviously an incredibly high-profile case, maybe arguably the most high-profile defendant in U.S. criminal history, maybe besides O.J. Simpson. But that brought a lot of people, a lot of attention to this issue. And, you know, luckily, Pennsylvania, the statute of limitations did not run out there, allowing the prosecutor to successfully prosecute Bill Cosby. And he is now obviously in prison. How much did the notoriety associated with that case assist in your efforts to get this bill on the governor's desk?
I think it was a combination of things. When we look at the Cosby situation, I happen to represent an area that overlaps very closely with the district that Denny Hastert once represented in the western suburbs. So that's been front and center. The whole Me Too movement and its energy in Springfield has a part of it. But a real part of this, in my mind, was reaching out and talking to individual legislators on a face-to-face basis to explain why I thought this was an important bill and moving it forward in a really bipartisan manner that was across, you know, every corner of the state. We had 44 or 45 sponsors the day we ran the bill on the House floor, which is more than a third of the members that could vote for it. So it was pressure came from everywhere to get it right, and I think we did get it right.
Well, it's good to see. I mean, you mentioned bipartisanship. It's good to see that even, you know, where we are right now as a state, and especially, you know, you were obviously in the minority as Republican. We just saw that recently with the, you know, lonely situation at Republican Day in Springfield last week, that, you know, you and Democrats could come together when it comes to a really important issue like this.
Yeah, well, I've been in the minority since I arrived in Springfield about 5 years ago. So it's been my usual practice to reach across the aisle for everything because I cannot pass a single thing with just Republican votes. And creating those relationships and developing an understanding of each other's backgrounds and districts and such, all that makes a difference going forward. So, you know, I feel like it turned out to be a good process for me to be a leader on because I already had those relationships pretty well created.
He is a sixth-generation resident of Kendall County, hailing from Oswego. Keith Wheeler, state representative from the 50th District. Representative, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
You can follow Legal Face Off on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. You can always find us on the iTunes store where you listen to all of your podcasts. Please rate, review, and listen to the show. Joining us now, Amber Rollins, director of KidsAndCars.org, to talk about the new Hot Cars Act. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Amber, hot car heat stroke fatalities continue to be a serious issue across the country. Since 2004, more than 600 children have died in hot car deaths. What are the reasons why children are being left in the back seats of cars?
Well, this is one of our biggest hurdles in trying to prevent these things because it's really difficult to understand how you could possibly lose awareness of your child in the back seat when they are, number one, above everything else, the most important thing in your world. And, you know, what we have learned after collecting data and researching these tragedies for 20 years is that this is happening to loving, responsible, highly educated parents and caregivers. And what happens is you've got a completely sleep-deprived, fatigued, stressed parent who is traveling about their day in their normal routine, and they're on autopilot. And, you know, we can all relate to that autopilot mode where, you know, you could kind of get from home to work without even thinking about where to turn or what to do. That's what autopilot is. And it's a great survival mechanism feature of our brains. But it's also very dangerous because when there's a change in that normal routine, and you're going from point A to point B, autopilot the part of your brain that's controlling what you're doing actually cannot account for a change in your routine. So if dropping the baby off at daycare is not a part of your normal getting from point A to point B, it's not going to happen unless you have some jarring, audio, visual reminder, the baby starts crying, you see the diaper bag sitting next to you, you know, something that snaps you out of that autopilot and reminds you. And that's where these parents get into this very dangerous situation where they literally have no idea that the baby's in the back seat. They go about their entire day at work thinking everything's fine. They even go to the daycare at the end of the day to pick up the baby. And they are so convinced that their child was there all day.
Yeah, very obviously these stories, we've seen them, especially recently, and they're incredibly sad. Amber, talk to us about some of the legislation that has been introduced, including the Hot Cars Act introduced in 2016. What is the aim of that legislation, and what have been the obstacles in getting these laws passed?
Well, the Hot Cars Act is a federal bill that requires a technological system in vehicles that could detect that a child is there and prevent them from being trapped inside. And we have been working on this bill, like you said, since 2016. We've reintroduced it this year, and we are just really hopeful that our legislators can get behind this and move it through. We're coming off of the worst year in history for children dying in hot cars. 53 died last year. I mean, when is enough going to be enough? I think someone said it to me really well the other day. They said, you know, we want more babies to die in hot cars, said no one ever. And, you know, nothing could be more true. Nobody wants babies dying in hot cars. We all want this to end. And, you know, sadly, after 20 years of educating and raising awareness, that's not making a difference. We have got to do more. And this technology is readily available. It's effective. And, you know, what are we waiting for?
Well, and as recently as last week, there was a headline that more than 50 family members of children who have lost their lives in hot car deaths actually wrote a letter to GM's chairwoman and CEO, Mary Barra, asking why GM had not fulfilled its promise back in 2001. So we're talking 18 years ago to implement this technology. And I think that they had promised to implement it by 2004. What are automakers saying is the reason why they have not yet implemented technology that has apparently been around for a while?
Well, GM did, there was a spokesperson that did provide a response to that, saying that the technology is not readily available and widespread through the industry because of challenges with, you know, the different configurations of vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all different types of vehicles. You know, there's the three-row SUVs and the tiny little sedans. And so they're saying that there's issues with the different configurations and getting the technology to work. And, you know, what I would say to that is it's simply not true. Kia and Hyundai both are featuring systems in select models right now that you can go to your local dealership and buy, and they have systems in them that detect the presence of a child or a living being in the back seat. They use motion sensing technology. We as an organization are contacted literally every single day by inventors working on systems, people who have systems available. They're trying to get them in with the automakers. And, you know, they use a variety of different sensing technologies. Some of them are weight sensing, some are motion sensing, some use carbon dioxide detection because that's what we exhale when we breathe. I mean, the systems that are available are really very effective, and there's just no excuse why we haven't made this available to all children.
Amber Wall, you were talking, I got a news flash that a 22-month-old died in a New Jersey hot car today. So I'm sure you're aware of, more than anyone, how often this is happening. You probably, you know the stats better than anyone. But the case that got a lot of attention in New York in July was the case involving the father who left his twins in the car. He was initially charged with homicide by the New York police, and then they dropped that charge. What are your thoughts on, what's your organization's thoughts on criminal prosecution of these cases? Anything from, you know, the most serious charge, of course, being homicide, but there's a variety of charges that authorities have leveled against parents in these situations. Is that an effective way to handle these situations? Is it a deterrent to others? Is it, you know, are these situations where you should be punishing parents criminally? What are your thoughts on that?
The whole point of criminalizing something is to deter it from happening. And we can't, you know, criminal charges in these cases are not going to do anything to prevent something that somebody doesn't realize they're doing from happening. You know, these parents have absolutely no idea that they're leaving their child behind. If they did, it wouldn't happen. And making a legal repercussion for that is not going to prevent it, period.
That's Amber Rollins, director of kidsandcars.org. Amber, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
It is time for the legal grab bag here on WGN, WGNradio.com. Joining us in the studio today, Esmeralda Leon, longtime WGN personality. Hi.
Yes, hello.
I haven't seen you in a long, long time.
I know. Did I see you on the Facebook?
The Facebook.
The Facebook. So I see your picture and all the fun you have.
Okay, well, I see what you do as well. Now that this is super weird, let's welcome in Kristen Hernandez, Senior Counsel at the McDonald's Corporation. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Are you on the Facebook or?
I am on the Facebook, yes.
Tina's Are you on the Twitter?
Tina's more of a MySpace person.
Tina has a Zanga still.
Mindspring.
So we have seven topics per usual, and we saved the best ones for last. So let's start here, Rich, with the, great topic. The Illinois felony murder law is number one of seven
today.
Well,
really interesting one because in the last couple of weeks, we saw this law in effect. So there was a car that was carrying five individuals up in Lake County, and they went up there to, if you believe the story, if you believe Lake County, the Lake County Sheriff's Department, they went up there to steal a car. And they got there and they got to this individual's house. And the homeowner, saying that he feared for his life, fired a gun at the group. It turns out that one of them had a knife. A knife was found on the driveway. He fired a gun, hit one of them in the head. That resulted in a high-speed chase between Lake County and Chicago, ending up here in the West Loop. And they eventually caught the rest of the suspects. And the individual who was shot in the head died from his injuries. So after that, the remaining members of this group were charged with murder under an Illinois law that allows the perpetrators of a crime to be charged with murder, even though they didn't pull the trigger. In this case, what was very interesting was that the homeowner was the one, obviously, who shot the young man, and the other offenders were charged with murder. Again, there is a felony murder statute in Illinois that allows the perpetrators of a crime to be charged with murder if one of them is murdered in the commission of a crime. That has resulted in many people questioning whether this law is just, whether it is fair. there is a racial component to it. The individual who owned the home was a white person, and these five individuals were African-American. Many are saying that if this was in Chicago, he would be charged with murder, that the shooter would be charged with murder. He was not charged with anything. He is allowed in Illinois. Any homeowner is allowed to actually use force. He's a FOID card holder. So there's a lot of issues surrounding this case. I think the two most interesting ones from a legal perspective are whether the homeowner should have been charged. In other words, was it reasonable for him to shoot and kill someone when they were there to steal his car? And number two, the more interesting one of the two, I think, is whether this law is just, whether you should be able to charge someone who was 14 years old, stealing a car, ends up being shot, and should these others be charged with murder? Tina, what are your thoughts on this case?
Well, I would prefer to take the second issue, which you framed as the more interesting one. I mean, I remember felony murder and studying it in law school, and my short answer is I think there are certain circumstances where it makes sense for it to be the law, but I think trying to apply it across the board is not necessarily, I don't think that you get the right solution, because I do think there are circumstances where a felony may be in the process of being committed and where a murder ends up taking place. And I think you may have certain circumstances where the people who are committing the felony do not have the ability to form the requisite intent or really understand what's going on to be charged for murder.
Yeah, to that point, the Supreme Court has ruled that minors cannot form the requisite intent sufficient for these kind of charges frequently. And I think what you're getting at is frequently it makes sense to charge someone. In other words, if you're going in to rob a bank and your intent is to just rob it, but you do so with a gun and the gun is discharged, you kill someone. Well, you understand there why you would charge someone with murder, even though they didn't intend to go in and kill someone.
Oh, absolutely. Because a lot of times people end up getting killed in those circumstances.
Yep. On the other hand, Esmeralda, many online, and I always look at, the way people look at these cases online, because as someone who tries a lot of cases before juries, that's sort of a free mock jury. And online, I'd say about 80% of people are saying that this was a good charge, that these young men should have known what they were in for, and they were, after all, going to steal a car. And that once you go on someone's property, and these were, the one individual did have a knife, then, it's right to be charged with murder. What are your thoughts?
I can understand being charged for something. I wouldn't understand being charged for murder, because that is not what happened. They stole a car. And unfortunately, what happened was the homeowner, had his rights, and he used his gun and he shot one of them. Unfortunately, he died. But I don't understand how the kids, because they're kids, that are stealing this car are now charged with murder. I'm amazed at 80%.
Kristen, old enough, though, to be charged. The prosecutors have some discretion to charge them as adults. One of the factors is always their prior history, and these individuals did have a prior criminal history. What are your thoughts on what Esmeralda said?
I completely agree. I think that when you just take the logic test and just your general reasonable person, what you think is reasonable, I don't think that anybody would think that some kids going in without a gun would be charged for murder when one of them is killed. The interesting thing about felony murder as well is that if the concept and the goal for having these laws on the books is as a deterrent from people conducting felonies, it's not going to happen if nobody knows about it. And I guarantee these kids had no idea that this was a potential outcome of what they were doing. So the statute is really not even accomplishing its purpose. And I don't think it's really a just result here.
And the U.S. is the only country in the world to apply this felony murder rule still. And Illinois has one of the broader versions of it anywhere in the country. So very interesting. It was also interesting that this chase took place all the way from Lake County to Chicago. And it was like a 100-mile-an-hour chase. So
it's a long chase.
It really is.
Topic number two, the Mooch is back on the show. We haven't talked about Scaramucci in a while. He was suspended on Twitter. And Tina, I would never have guessed this would be the reason why.
Well, yes. Our friend Scaramucci, as you said, has been quiet for a while. But he's been getting a lot of airplay the last few days. So late last week, it was on Friday, he received a notification from Twitter that his account was suspended for over 7 hours because he violated Twitter's abusive behavior policy when he tweeted that Trump is the fattest president since William Howard Taft. Apparently, in these situations, when someone violates this policy, accounts remain locked until the offending tweet gets removed. Well, apparently Scaramucci's tweet, and I think a lot of people realized, was in response to Trump making fun of a protester in New Hampshire on Thursday when Trump told a crowd of supporters, "That guy's got a serious weight problem. Go home and start exercising." So since the end of last week, so Scaramucci was back online pretty promptly, and he's remained in the headlines, and he's now talking about how he's putting together a coalition to stop Trump in the 2020 election. He's been pretty pejorative in some of the things he said about Trump, including using words such as jackass, crazy, narcissistic, and paper tiger. And he claims that he thinks Trump will drop out of the 2020 race to avoid the humiliation of losing. So what's interesting is that Trump has not been silent either in all of this. And he has said that his former aide is a nut job and that he barely knew him. But of course, I haven't seen his Twitter account being suspended. So,
yeah, I mean, the legal issue, I think, is whether this is a First Amendment violation for Twitter to suspend him for 7 hours and, what, 40 minutes. We've seen a lot of criticism of social media lately in that they're not taking enough control, right? I mean, we want them to shut down hate speech and, you know, white supremacy. We want that to be shut down. Yet, are we also criticizing them when they do that? I think if you're asking Twitter and social media to step in and, you know, filter what people are saying, you can't then turn around and criticize them for violating free speech, as many are doing in the Scaramucci incident. So from a legal perspective, you know, I think most of the speech out there should be unlimited. I mean, it's social media. And I don't think Twitter should suspend many licenses. But once you're doing so, you can't pick and choose which one you like. You can't say, well, we don't like, you know, white supremacist talk, but we will okay Scaramucci or vice versa. So, you know, let Scaramucci speak. I do think it's hypocritical for Trump to be criticizing anyone's looks, right? And he should be called out on Twitter. So I support the mooch.
I support the mooch.
Guys, what do you think of this issue?
Can we maybe, like, historically, can we look through all the presidents and see if it's actually true? Because I don't know.
Oh, whether he is the fattest?
Think it
is true that
will be the
careful
case.
Well, it is
careful.
True
can that
maybe I'll end up without, you know, the ability to talk for 7 hours people, on no, my social media platforms.
They won't be able to listen to Legal Face Off for 7 hours.
Taft was a bigger man and he was not very
he just
healthy.
Made it sound like this could be looked up in history. And
what other candidates? Clinton, maybe. Clinton was not the most fit president.
Okay, Clinton was a lot more fit than a lot of other presidents.
Yeah, who do you got in mind? McKinley? Are you big on the McKinley?
It's like these facts have to be somewhere.
According to the internet, William Howard Taft was 6 feet and weighed over 350 pounds.
Mm. Yeah.
What does Trump weigh?
Definitely qualifies.
I haven't weighed him in a while, but I think he's. I don't know. Kristen, what do you think of this whole situation?
I think that, from a cynical standpoint, it really, just all joking aside and politics aside, it's really makes me think that Twitter has some sort of an interest in protecting Trump because he has really elevated Twitter's status.
Excellent.
And he is known as tweeting. SNL, all he does is tweet. And so it's actually, to your point, not reasonable for them to pick and choose who they're going to censor because they allow him to say a lot of things that is more offensive than calling someone fat. And I question Twitter's intent here, and I think it makes them look bad.
So Twitter wants to keep Trump talking. That's why they suspended any opponent of Trump.
Well, yeah.
Interesting.
You know he sent something to somebody from Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Because somebody sent it to him, and then he cried wolf. That's probably what happened. By the way, Donald Trump, 6'3", 243. Those are the measurables there.
Qualifies as overweight, for sure.
He's no 350, though.
No, he's not 350.
Like,
this was literally in response to him fat shaming someone.
Right.
Yes.
But that is still on Twitter. right?
Yeah, I think that is.
So
Taft was very active on Twitter, though, back in the back in the day.
Some say worse than Trump. Yeah. The man was
Taft loved. He was more of a Facebook guy, though.
He was a Facebook.
A lot of Insta.
He was on
Insta
the Facebook.
Yeah. I already liked Pinterest, too. That's what I heard.
He's a big meme guy.
Coolidge was big on Snapchat.
Heather Locklear has pled no contest in her fight with deputies.
Yeah, Heather Locklear on Friday in Ventura County pled, as you said, no contest to 5 counts of battery on a peace officer, 1 count of battery on an emergency personnel, and 2 counts of resisting arrest. The judge sentenced her to 120 days in jail, but he suspended the sentence pending her completion of a substance abuse program. This was emanating from a couple of different domestic disputes at her home back in 2018, where she pushed, kicked, and shouted at them. So Heather Locklear has fallen on some hard times. Hopefully she'll get herself some help. But the big question is, will there be a Melrose Place reboot like we saw the 90210? Anyone watching the 90210 reboot?
Absolutely. Huge 90210 fan.
What do we think of the reboot? Do you like it? It's a little hard to watch.
That right? was a collective.
Yeah,
it's is not it so actually good. Them? I thought I had heard that it's them playing
their themselves.
That's the part that I'm on. I'm not sure what's happening.
I want to see
that.
Brandon Walsh. Agreed. Being Brandon Walsh.
Agreed. I'm hoping it goes back to that.
Yeah.
Maybe
I don't know.
Next episode. I keep hoping for that.
But you know, Melrose Place is a spinoff. I mean, any true 90210 expert will know that Melrose Place was a spinoff of 90210.
Would they still be living in that apartment complex?
Well, that's the question. That place has been condemned. But Jake, remember Jake came from, Jake was dating Kelly.
Yep.
Which was a weird thing because Kelly was like 16 and Jake was, you know, probably 29. And then.
Perfectly normal. That's fine.
He brought her to Melrose Place and that's how Melrose Place started. You know the other spinoff from Melrose Place? Let's see how much you really know this one.
I don't.
Models Inc. Remember Models Inc.?
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Come on.
I was watching Ninja Turtles at this
You're
time.
A big so
little snapshot
fan.
Of my sorry, depressing life in the 90s.
What I want to know is if there's going to be a reboot of her and Richie Sambora.
Yeah, don't think so. Too much drugs. There's a lot of drugs on both sides of that equation.
They
I think.
Seem to be coping better together than they are doing apart.
Here's a segue: Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown.
No, we're done with Locklear. I had a whole T.J. Hooker.
Adrian
Zibed. I can't push rewind, Hooker. But we can.
You guys, T.J. Hooker fans? No,
I was a big T.J. Hooker
but 90% of it was Shatner on the hood of the squad car while a bad guy was driving him. It was like just him holding onto that hood. All right, we go to
as I said,
Whitney,
Bobby Brown, Whitney Houston, Showtime documentary. Go.
Okay. So in 2018, Bobby Brown and the estate of his daughter, Christina Bobby Brown, brought a lawsuit against BBC and Showtime over the Whitney Houston documentary, Whitney, Can I Be Me? So earlier in August, the New York federal court dismissed the complaint based on, again, the First Amendment. It rears its ugly head once again. So there were a bunch of objections that Bobby Brown raised. First, he didn't like the fact that his release wasn't sought by BBC and Showtime, which would have authorized the use of his and his daughter's likeness in the documentary. The response to that from the judge was that the documentary is an expressive work, which is based on true events, and therefore it's not protected under, therefore it's protected under the First Amendment and the consent is not needed. He was also claiming that the fact that he didn't get, that his consent wasn't provided, and the fact that the folks that were making the movie, he said they didn't make it clear that he wasn't affiliated with the movie at all. And so the response to that was that the producer specifically identified who was responsible for the film and he wasn't listed among them. And so that was shot down as well. And apparently there was also footage from his reality series being Bobby Brown that was included in the documentary. And so he may actually end up suing again, this time in state court to pursue that avenue. But it's really sad that after all the trauma and tragedy with Christina and with Whitney Houston, that we're in court over something like this. He clearly didn't like how he was depicted.
Did you all see the documentary?
I haven't seen it, no.
It's pretty good. It's
how is he depicted?
Not good. Very Bobby Brownish.
Oh, so himself.
Yeah.
Okay. Accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does he have evidence to suggest he doesn't act? You know what I mean? Like he has something. Well, that's not me at all because I do this and this.
Are you? Oh, I thought maybe you were playing my prerogative or something.
This is your phone, not mine.
One of your favorite Bobby Brown songs.
I heard New Edition the other day and it made me almost have a tear come down my eye.
Yeah, Mr. Telephone Man.
Those were the better days for Bobby Brown.
Sure was.
Was he mad about that one? The BET New Edition
movie? Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure there's a lawsuit involved there. But Ronnie, Bobby, Ricky, and Mike, if I love the girl, who cares who you like? That's cool it now.
Yeah, I know. That was my favorite song of theirs.
Yeah.
I love that song. I like Candy Girl.
Lots of pop culture on this legal grab bag. Topic number five.
By the way, I dated William Shatner's niece. Could I tell you that story?
Wow. Back
to our T.J. Hooker story.
You keep cutting me off as I'm trying to transition.
Well, Shatner's from Montreal. In fact, I went to McGill University in Montreal, and our student union building is called the William Shatner Center. And, for a few months I dated a...
What's her last
Shatner's,
name? Is her last name Shatner?
Say that on
is her last
WGN
name Shatner?
Radio. No, it's not.
Okay.
Did you get to meet the man himself at all?
No, that was the main reason why I did. I never. I'm just kidding. No, but I never
that
met.
That is nasty, Rich.
I never met Uncle Bill.
That favorite Shatner role
impersonation.
Favorite Shatner role.
Shatner.
You know mine.
Rescue 911.
Mine's Denny Crane.
Denny Crane.
Denny Crane's incredible.
Sure. Great.
Denny Crane was great.
Star Trek, all the way.
Mm-hmm. Denny Crane. Denny Crane.
Undefeated in the court of law. Antonio Brown, new receiver, former Steelers receiver. He is fighting his team. He is fighting the league. And now he is fighting a celebrity chef.
Sam, is this the worst opening for any free agent in NFL history? I mean, he couldn't play in training camp, as we saw in Hard Knocks, because his feet were all jacked up. And
he went in the cryo tank with no footwear on.
Yeah, cryo tank with no footwear. Couldn't wear an NFL helmet because he wanted his old helmet. Mike Mayock was just on Hard Knocks or on the news yesterday, the GM of the Raiders, saying, you're in or you're out. Basically, get to camp. And now we see yet another lawsuit. He's been involved in a couple lawsuits, actually. He settled a case where he stiffed a trainer a few years ago. He also settled a lawsuit involving throwing furniture out the window, and some people said they were traumatized by it. But the latest one is, he stiffed a chef in Florida who cooks for a lot of celebrities, and the allegation is that he did not pay him $40,000 from a January 2018 party at the Pro Bowl that allegedly Brown stiffed him on. So what the hell is wrong with Antonio Brown?
He has a lot of issues.
Yeah. What do you guys think?
I want to know, was this a buffet for these meals?
Because
$50 per person for breakfast?
Yep.
What are you eating?
Mimosas. Yeah.
That's it. That's where it gets you. $65 for lunch? $112 I could maybe understand because you're going to go really fancy and nice.
A little Wagyu.
$50 for breakfast? Better be an omelet bar on there.
Yeah. Well, it was every day for 3 days of the Pro Bowl, every meal, right?
He cooked more than 100 meals over a two-day period, and then Brown fired him halfway through the three-day job. And then the worst part of the lawsuit is that the chef wasn't allowed to retrieve his equipment or allowed to look at Brown.
what's up with that?
To be fair, we have that in our contracts here at WGN. Tina and I.
Eyes to the ground and I walked in.
No eye contact. It's a reasonable request, I think.
I wonder if he got his stuff back. Because it's not in the fees.
Yeah,
he didn't, and I would think his equipment is very expensive.
Well, the lesson here is when you hire a celebrity chef, make sure when you work with Antonio Brown, make sure you get paid in advance.
When Ronald McDonald shows up at the LFO Christmas party, we will pay the bill.
Are you going to bring him to the Christmas party, Kristen? Are you going to get Ronald McDonald to come?
I mean, if I'm invited and Ronald's invited, I'll do my best. He's a very busy man.
I'm sure he's kind of like Santa Claus, right?
Except real.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
You got to leave our listeners with a secret McDonald's menu item that no one knows about. There's got to be a couple that are still unknown that only a select few know. Think about that one. Give us one before we close off.
I'll need a minute to think about it. But
sure.
All right.
Nah.
All right.
You're about to give it up.
Yeah.
I was excited.
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
All right.
Our sixth topic here on Legal Face Off, the legal grab bag, as I flip Rich's camera around to film on Facebook Live, involves Wayne Newton's monkey.
Only Rich would come up with a story like
this. Let's leave that. That's the alternative title to our podcast, by the way. That's a rejected title is Wayne Newton's monkey. Yeah, a woman in Vegas who filed a complaint on Wednesday is suing Wayne Newton because a monkey bit her daughter during a visit to his mansion. The young lady was 15 years old at the time, and she had to go to the hospital because she was bit by an uncaged capuchin monkey. Is that how you pronounce? Sam, you're a monkey expert. Capuchin?
No monkey? Idea.
Only chimpanzees.
Bit her on the right wrist.
Confused.
During a tour of the mansion, which is called Casa de Shenandoah, back in 2017. Newton's wife has said, we don't have any relationship to the Casa anymore because they sold the rights a few years ago, so they're not responsible. And in fact, Wayne Newton at the time was suffering from, let me make sure I get this part right, life-altering spider bites. So I don't know what the hell's
okay,
going
what's
on in
going on in this place?
What's going on in this mansion, but a lot of animals and insects running wild, biting people.
I kind of want to know, can we go now?
Yeah.
Can we go to this mansion now?
What is a life-altering insect bite?
A life-threatening spider bite. Who knows?
I mean, have you seen the pictures online?
I have not.
There's, you know, growths and other spider babies come out from his bite.
I think once you're in Wayne Newton's house, you know, it's like caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. You never know what's going to spring out of, you know, the walls at this place. So
what kind of a tour was this? Why were they in his house? Yeah. And who was responsible for the tour?
And was that monkey supposed to be in a cage?
Yeah.
And it got out.
That's the question. It's okay to have a caged monkey at the Wayne Newton mansion, but not uncaged. So
I think she took the monkey out of the cage.
Touch my monkey. Love him. Liebisch mein monkey. Now it's his time on Sprockets when we dance.
Should I move on?
Yes, probably. We've beaten to death the Wayne Newton monkey story.
Last topic involves happiness hacks.
So, yes.
How not to be happy.
How not to be happy. Or how to be happy.
So get a monkey!
This is courtesy of a CNBC story that was run a few days ago. And it was very funny. It was this list of secrets to happiness for all of you.
All normal stuff.
Yeah, all normal
stuff.
Well,
don't be a lawyer.
Yeah, it's like turning everything on its head. So what I loved was, number one, was stop apologizing. So for all of you folks who have a hard time getting the emails, and, you know, it takes you more than 6 seconds to respond to one. Stop apologizing.
Now, this is totally coincidental because, you know, we picked up the story today. But here, you got to see my socks today. As a Canadian, what does it say?
It says, okay, of course.
Sorry.
It says sorry. Oh, can you say
my
funny,
socks
Rich?
Say sorry.
I love your accent,
we
Rich.
Canadians are known to apologize.
Can you say about? Can you say the word about?
About.
So please, people, stop apologizing. Second, for all of you homeowners, sell your houses. For all of you would-be homeowners, don't even go out and buy one because you're supposed to rent instead of buy. Third, don't retire early. Work until you're at least 65. How does that sound, Rich?
No, I'm ready.
Four,
I'm leaving after the show for good.
Embrace getting older. So those aches and pains that you feel, don't let them get you down. And be happy that you're aging. Number five, and what's critical to this discussion, don't be a lawyer. So for all you lawyers in the room, we don't have a complete group of lawyers, but for the lawyers in the room, if you could do it all over again, would you be a lawyer?
Absolutely. So this is the one I have the biggest beef with, because
so to speak. Turn of phrase.
I love being a lawyer, and I would not be happy if I couldn't be a lawyer. I disagree with some of the other points, and I agree with some of the other ones, but I think this is a broad generalization, and I strongly disagree with that.
Richie?
Where would Legal Face Off be if we weren't lawyers?
I don't know.
It would just be called
Face Off.
I am not a lawyer in the least. I did date a lawyer once. Everyone knows he was a lawyer to be. He took me to one of his classes and I fell asleep. So
you broke up with him.
That too.
Sam?
I am lawyers. Not a lawyer. I only
You've
play
been around a lot of lawyers now for
television.
A few years.
Yes.
We're pretty happy. No.
Well, the last one is complain with purpose. So, Sam, if you're ever going to complain,
do it with purpose.
I just know who to call if I get in trouble. I'm building a very good Rolodex of lawyers that come on to the show.
All right, Kristen, you promised the McDonald's secret menu item that we could all go right now and order. What would that be?
Well, rather than just give you one item, I'm going to tell you the real secret, which is that you can ask for anything to be customized with any of the ingredients that we have. So we all know all of our fantastic, delicious, and amazing ingredients. You can make whatever you want.
So it's funny that you say that because I represent McDonald's also, like Tina. And a few years ago, I asked them, put me in a restaurant so I could really, you know, understand your business. And they actually did. And they put me in a restaurant in the West suburbs, and people would come up to the register and say, oh, I want my fries, but I want them well done. And I looked at the first guy. I'm like, where do you think you are, buddy? It's Gibson's. It's McDonald's, for Christ's sake. But it turns out you can customize a lot of your food. And it was the slowest day, by the way, in this restaurant's history, because I was like, while that clock is running behind me.
Oh, you're running the register?
Oh, I was working behind the cash.
Did you have a visor on?
Absolutely.
You had the whole outfit?
Oh, yeah, I did.
All corporate employees get to work at a restaurant, actually, when you first start. So I had a fantastic week when I started, and we have a day of giving back where everybody goes and works in a restaurant once a year as well, which is really, it's really interesting, isn't it?
All right, so everyone's favorite McDonald's item, real quick, around the room.
McRib.
McRib.
Ooh. Whoa. Nuggets. Wow. Fries.
I was going to go McDouble.
McDouble. So,
but I dunk it in the sweet and sour sauce. That's my weird thing. It's delicious.
I love poutine.
You look like a Tuscan chicken.
No, man, I love poutine. You can only get it in Canada. Although they did.
In the West Loop, we had the poutine for a while. We have a rotating international menu headquarters.
But you had a Canadian burger. I didn't know you had the poutine.
We had the poutine for a certain amount of time. I tried it. It's fantastic because our fries are great.
Try it at like 4 a.m. That's the best time to enjoy a poutine generally.
And remember, in the 90s, when the Bulls were good, they had the beef Wennington.
Did
which
they really?
Had Canadian bacon on it.
Ooh. Oh,
you don't remember that?
No, that's amazing.
I figured that'd be your favorite.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was a burger with Canadian bacon.
You know you've made it when, like, you're the 11th guy on the Bulls bench. You got a burger named after you.
The beef Wennington.
Wow.
Look
it
up.
That's amazing.
Nice.
Did I miss anything?
It's good. No.
We good to go?
We're good.
I think we're good to go.
Ladies, thanks for coming
McDonald's
in.
McDonald's for everyone.
Thank you.
Kristen brought in fries for everyone.
We're going to do shots of sweet and sour in the break.
Yes. All right.
For Rich and Tina and Ben, I'm Sam. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.